as I said, I want to switch over to a more sober discussion, picking up on those points that I mentioned towards the end about making a government complacent and so forth. Gabriel Krause is a writer and analyst at the Institute for Race Relations joining us this evening. Gabriel, thank you so much for your time and good evening.
Good evening. It's very good to be here. Thank you for having me.
Let's pick up from that idea that is replicated now in so many other, so many parts of the country to minor degrees or major degrees. I mean, just in my own community out here in Benoni, a few nights ago, saw, you know, community members in the dead of the night taking it upon themselves to fill potholes and exercise that they do regularly. You have the example of the Shell Cross, a major project, repairing an entire bridge and doing it in a record period of time. And in other cases, communities have taken over, as we've seen as a result of court action, entire waterworks, and much, much more. Is this firstly becoming increasingly from the data before us the norm in many parts of South Africa?
It is difficult to collate the data clearly because there isn't an effective nationwide tracking of the various ways in which ordinary South Africans are standing up for themselves, saying government's not doing its job, but someone has to do the job. We can't just let things dilapidate and deteriorate, so we're going to take it upon ourselves. Unfortunately, there's no real systematic way of tracking that. But one of the proxies to look at is the annual audits coming out of the Auditor General, and those results really are stark. You're looking at half of municipalities around the country, just about, basically completely failing to meet the basic standards of good auditing, and then another third that are doing a pretty shoddy job, so that you only really have about 10% of municipalities in the country that are getting proper clean audits. And the reason that's a good proxy is because as soon as the municipality's gotten to the stage where it's spending money without being able to transparently report how and why it's spending that money and what kind of procurement processes it went through in order to make sure it is getting the best bang for buck for ordinary citizens. As soon as that has gone away, the rot has already begun to set in, which starts out with just wasteful, irregular, and fruitless expenditure and ends up with, because the money's been wasted, the infrastructure's not working, the bridges aren't holding, the stormwater drains aren't doing their job, the water reticulations aren't working, the sewage is literally just pouring out into the pavement, the potholes are dominating the road, and then people have to stand up and take charge. I think that the particular Shell Cross example is inspiring partly because it is so immediately responsive to a national crisis. I mean, the floods were centered in KZN, but we saw it around the country. You're in Benoni, I'm in sort of central Joburg, but we all kind of knew how devastating, hundreds and hundreds of people dying, how devastating things were in KZN. And for a community so soon after that to get their act together and say, we really need to literally build a bridge, and actually achieve that is very impressive. That does, I think it shines a light on a problem that sits with most South Africans every day of the year. And the disaster sort of shines a light on it, but it's there even when the spotlight isn't there. And that's why I think my suspicion is that South Africans are making the kinds of moves you described at an even higher level than most people generally get the public sense of. In my tours of the countryside and KZN, in Northwest, in the Free States, and in Mpumalanga during the pandemic, I increasingly saw people. The number one thing over the last decade has been in terms of security in rural South Africa and in urban South Africa. There's a lot more private security by different measures. We've got private security outnumbering the police maybe threefold, maybe fivefold. But also just people getting together to pick up litter and clean the streets and fix the lights. And those kinds of moves are, you know, that's the day-to-day stuff that I think really makes a difference.
Talk to us a bit about this idea, the concept, the hashtag that you've coined as well at the Institute of Race Relations. This is something you've been talking about for a while. The stop citizen abuse. What constitutes abuse of citizens in your conception?
Thank you. Yeah, so oddly enough, what you were describing there in Benoni, we started the Stop Citizen Abuse campaign when we just came across a community on the East Rand of Joburg that couldn't really drive around, where traffic going into a school was being completely blocked and the municipality kept getting called and was doing nothing about it. So people got a little bit of money together and filled in their own potholes. And it struck us that citizenship is an interdependent relationship. I think different faiths have different ways of expressing it. I quite like the expression, the Ubuntu expression, that a person is somehow only really able to fully express their personality through a collaboration with other people. I think that is a basically correct idea, and I think it's given real expression in citizenship. We're part of the bargain, and this is not all esoteric. Part of the bargain is you pay taxes, and you get services in exchange for that. And a very important part of that is safety. Another very important part of that is that the organs that make us safe, the organs that make society work, are centralized and powerful. It's a very powerful thing, a government. Even a government as decrepit as ours seems to be in so many ways, so many basic functions not being fulfilled, there's still a very, very serious concentration of power there. And with that power comes responsibility. That's the trade-off. We as citizens, we pay due respect to the law. We pay our taxes forward. We report on crimes and misdemeanors that we see around us. We try to be good neighbors. That's what we need to be doing. And in exchange, and as part of that, the state needs to be guarding our basic rights, the rights that are written down clearly for us all to understand in the constitution of this country, ratified in 1996. And citizen abuse is what happens when the state is derelict in that duty. And I suppose you can see different tiers of it, but it starts with just negligence. But it gets to the point where the state is willfully and deliberately bringing private citizens down. Because a different kind of bargain, and this is a sort of classic observation from political science, I think, over the last 500 years. So the other way that it works is a kind of domination by fear, is that if the state can't give you what it wants, then it corners you into a position where fear leads to timidity and to apathy. And that can happen many ways. It can happen by, you know, this example we were referring to where the municipality is not doing its job. And then people get involved and try and go and fill in the potholes. Then suddenly the police arrive and say, no, you can't do that. Where's your license? I was involved with the Harry Smith Water Heroes project, where Harry Smith didn't have any water for months. And it had low water pressure for years, so that some parts of the town were hugely underserviced. But literally for months, it had no water at all, which was insane because it's connected to, you know, one of the largest dam systems in the country. But the pipes just hadn't been well tended. And every time the municipality was bothered to go and do something about it, they'd say no and they'd start getting a bit aggressive with the people who were making the complaint, saying, you know, what's your problem? This is not for you to tell us what to do. Anyway, eventually, when the Harry Smith Water Heroes first started to get involved, municipal officials actually tried to chase them away, literally saying it would be better for the town to continue to have no water, for people to be unable to clean themselves, to rinse out the sewage, to have the most basic rights respected. It's better to just abandon that, block that off, than it is to let someone else go and do the job and get a bit of credit for it, and then that means the politicians don't get the credit. That's abusive behavior. It's clearly the kind of thing that if it happened in a relationship between two individuals, someone, you know, locks their partner up and leaves them without water for a week, that would be abuse. That would be domestic abuse. Citizen abuse is what happens when the government's doing that to us. And if it's a cop demanding a bribe, if it's an official refusing to do their job, if it's really small-level corruption or grand-scale corruption, where literally hundreds of billions of rand, not a trillion rand, gets pilfered from the citizen's public purse over the period of a decade, that's hugely abusive. If it's life threatening to many, if it's a public hospital for people who have mental problems, where because of corruption, they effectively get abandoned, locked away, deprived of food, to the point where 100 people more or less starve to death, that is abuse. That's an abuse conducted by a government against its citizens. If you look at the, you know, one of the tricky ones for the Institute of Race Relations is that one of the first major research projects we did was back in apartheid. There's terrible citizen abuse. There's the abusive way in which the police would arrest people and detain them without trial. That was outrageous citizen abuse. And the Institute back in the 50s was tracking that and collating the data and setting it up to shine a light on it so that people could see this and begin to turn against it. And yet today, there's, in a different kind of way, there's a very similar problem where our court system and our judicial system is so messed up that getting forensic evidence is almost impossible. We're getting processing through the system, you know, it's like all the crooks get let out and people get stuck in there. The numbers of people, thousands of people stuck in for years without a trial because they're just waiting for their court date, because their dockets keep getting lost, because the prosecutor keeps getting replaced or forgetting to come to work, because the magistrate doesn't really know how to process the case. There's been thousands of people sitting for years in a new form of detention without trial that unfortunately gets no attention. To my mind, that is abusive. That is not part of the bargain of a civilized, democratic, constitutional country that we belong to. We all need to put something in as private citizens. But we need to demand that we get the respect due to our status. And so that does mean we need to stand up and be vocal and say we need to stop the citizen abuse. And I think that Marcus was speaking earlier, I think he spoke to that difficult tension in a way. Because on the one hand, as citizens, we need to work together. And not just with citizens, also with, you know, residents, but we need to work together within our communities. We need to build the bridges. We need to help each other out. And that does require a friendliness and a practicality and a kind of, you know, just get it done attitude. But at the same time, we also need to demand something more, because without a reform of the way the government works, without an actual confrontation with the state, which is this powerful center that has the most awesome ability to force citizen abuse, without confronting that, I'm afraid that the small victories become unsustainable.
For example.
Sorry.
That's obviously a very detailed exposition you've given there of the different manifestations, Gabriel, of citizen abuse. And unfortunately, I'm kind of out of time to explore this very important topic further, but I just want to conclude on that particular point. This abuse, as you've put forward the metaphor, has extremely deep levels of trauma for ordinary citizens, lived trauma every day of their lives. But now the question dealing with the tension that you've mentioned, are you coming to a level of prescription for citizens whereby if citizens become organized, as people are increasingly doing, and take affairs into their own hands, it reaches a point where it becomes unsustainable then to be, forwarding resources in both directions to the government through techs, and on the other hand, doing the same work through private projects. So it's kind of a double spending of money that's occurred. So are you, very briefly, although this might be another broad point, but very briefly, are you advocating in any way for a tax revolt if citizens are forced to take the functioning of municipalities and municipal services into their own hands?
No, I'm going to stop short of a tax revolt because in terms of what we don't advocate that. That strikes me as a short-term, it's just another short-term unsustainable solution. The right idea is to call for rebates to use the law and get them. We tried that last year as part of our citizen abuse anti-citizen abuse campaign. We tried to leverage municipalities and the Department of Public Administration to grant rebates. Now, we failed. They had the power to do that under the state of disaster. It explicitly says if there's a state of disaster and that is causing service delivery not to be meted out, then the government has the power, if not the duty, to actually rebate to taxpayers what they're paying in because they're not getting it out. Now, we tried and we failed. But citizens have got to keep trying until they succeed in a legal fashion. The country requires the rule of law to hold us together. Anarchy is nobody's friend, excepting for the most powerful bully in the room. And unfortunately, no one's going to last very long in that position. So I think that you've identified the problem very precisely. It's the double spending problem. The only sustainable solution to that problem is to rein in government spending and to efficientize it to the point where you don't have to double spend, where the government's actually doing the job. And countries around the world have proven capable of doing this, and it's always required the same thing. It's required citizens that vote out corrupt and inept administrators, vote in fresh blood if that's what's needed, reward those at a political level who are already proving that they can do a good job. So we don't advocate for any political party, but we do notice that in countries that work, you have a change of power in a way that we haven't yet seen in South Africa since the all-race constitutional dispensation has come along. But we're very excited to see the results that came out of the 2021 election. Let's not give up hope on this country and fixing it through the democratic process, especially not after the results at a municipal level that we saw last year. Never before has the ANC come below 50%, and there it did. Even in KZN, we saw changes of power that were very interesting, and across the country. I think that there are a lot of opposition parties, some new, some old, that have interesting things to offer. And citizens that engage in fixing their own problems for now are also going to be in a good position to see a bulldust artist coming along. I want to use the polite expression. But some politicians come and promise the moon and they can deliver nothing. But practical people who've actually worked in a communal way are going to be good at identifying practical politicians who say, look, this is the plan. This is how we're going to make sure you're not double spending. This is how we're going to rein in government largesse. This is how we're going to cut short corruption. This is how we're going to make sure we deliver the services. I think that following that process, that democratic process, it does mean trial and error. It does mean a lot of difficulty and a lot of hana-hana some of the time. But ultimately, it is the path to the greatest potential for individual liberty and prosperity. And I think that's what our constitution secures for us in theory. And it's just what we as citizens need to stand up and practice. And if we do it, I've got a lot of hope.
Indeed, a very important and productive discussion there. People can check out memorandums that have been prepared in this regard and follow the hashtag to dig deeper into this discussion. The hashtag was Stop Citizen Abuse. I thank you so much for your time. This evening, Gabriel Krause is writer and analyst at the Institute for Race Relations. Have yourself a great week ahead, Gabriel.
All the best, and to you. Thank you.